those of you that have just listened to BBC News, if you've ever been to India, you must be in hysterics over the announcement that the Indian bureaucracy is being investigated for incompetence and malfeasance. Okay, today's show. It is the 10th of September. Our British correspondent has sent us the following perspectives from his regal nation. First item, America becomes the world's largest council estate last night after U.S. government bought all the houses. With the nationalization of the country's biggest mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Washington can now begin painting all the front doors the same color and filling the gardens with rubbish. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson said, quote, by taking Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae into state control, the U.S. government is now the second biggest owner of third-rate homes after Liverpool City Council. He added, quote, since the Pilgrim Fathers set foot on Plymouth Rock, the American dream has been about working hard and owning your own home, until now, when the government suddenly turns into a bunch of communists and buys up all the mortgages. Rest assured, we will choose a sickly blue-green color for your front door and inject damp into the walls in time for Christmas. Mr. Paulson continued, now we all know that when the government owns your home, you have an immediate and irresistible urge to use it as one big toilet. All I would say is, do at least try to use the lavatory, but if not, then please sweep all of your droppings into the corner of the room and cover them in sawdust. Meanwhile, economist Tom Logan warned, if all Americans are now effectively council tenants, then it's only a matter of time before they become fat, ignorant bastards who sit around all day eating huge bags of chips and watching X Factor. Next item, also out of the British. New research suggests cannabis is now more evil than the Nazis, and smoking the drug is worse for the brain than listening to the music of Barry Manilow. During the 60s, smoking dope was hardly evil at all, and the drug was more playful and slightly naughty, but in a nice way. In the 70s and 80s, marijuana briefly became totally harmless and could be smoked by future cabinet ministers up to the rank of Home Secretary without any effect on their brains whatsoever. However, a massive increase in the strength of the drug, since politicians all stopped using it, has now made it more nasty and brutish than the combined evil of the Third Reich. Professor Tom Broker, head of drug research at Glasgow's Clyde University, and the man who conducted the latest lengthy study into the drug said, yeah, whatever. A spokesman for the university said, the Nazis were very bad people, but even they could not make a middle-class white boy adopt dreadlocks for a hairstyle, or make a highly intelligent middle-aged man crawl around the floor of his laboratory in his underpants, weeping with laughter about nothing at all, and then eating his own weight in marshmallows. Okay, that's from our British correspondent. I'm not responsible. Rabble-rousing shows are now archived and can be heard on at your convenience 24/7. Tell your friends to go to KVMR's homepage, and then in the right-hand column, click on Program Schedule, then click on Program Page for Rabble-Rousing with Chamberlain. Past shows will be listed there. My commentary for today, Wednesday, 10th of September. Let me begin by confessing that I don't know what to report on this morning. The specter of Sarah Palin becoming our next president is so frightening to me that it obscures all other thoughts. First of all, we must congratulate the Republicans for a brilliant political move in selecting her. John McCain's campaign seemed dead in the water until invigorated by her selection. As a staunch religious fundamentalist, she'll bring the religious right back into the fold, assuming they ever left, and she'll pick up female voters who are so disillusioned with male politicians that they will knee-jerk vote for any woman candidate, no matter how unqualified or opposed to their interests. There might be many Hillary supporters who are still so pissed off that their candidate failed to win the Democratic nomination that they will vote for Sarah in protest. If so, Lord help us. The absurdity of McCain's choice is that after months of lambasting Barack Obama for his alleged lack of foreign affairs experience, the Republicans have defied logic and committed the epitome of hypocrisy by choosing Sarah Palin, who not only has absolutely zero experience at politics out of her home state of Alaska, let alone international experience, but she's on record as once being a member of an Alaskan political party whose prime objective was Alaska First, and its publicly stated platform advocated seceding from the Union. Republican hypocrisy? What a novel concept. Several listeners have sent me a web posting of a letter written by a woman who lives in Sarah Palin's small hometown of Wasilla, Alaska, the town she was mayor of before she won the governorship of Alaska. So I debated over whether to read you that letter. It's lengthy, and since Wasilla is a small town, its author knows Sarah personally. If you call in and insist, I'll read it. If not, let me paraphrase it. It details several instances that indicate a small-minded, fanatical religious fundamentalist and one who delegated all political decisions to others. It is critical to note that these are the only two political offices she's ever held and the only political experience she's had. She was mayor of a small Alaskan town and then is now serving her first term as governor of a very unusual state. I say unusual not because Alaska and its needs are very remote and different from the continental U.S., which they are, but because Alaska is the only state in our union with an economic surplus. Because of its oil wealth, Alaska has plenty of money to play with, unlike the rest of us and most of the world. The problem facing Alaskan politicians is not where to get money, but how to allocate and spend all the money they do have. So the governor of this state has issues to deal with that are unique to her state. Sarah Palin is the least qualified candidate to ever run for high national political office since Kiki Friedman or Bozo the Clown. And it's very significant that American politics has recently changed dramatically. Before the ascension of Dick Cheney, the office of vice president was largely ceremonial. Name me a vice president before Cheney who had any relevance whatsoever. But the ineptitude of George W., coupled with the power aspirations of Cheney, changed that equation. George W. became the figurehead, the man who plays at being president, while the vice president, Cheney, made all the significant decisions. Who is over in Georgia right now, angering the Russians, implementing neocon imperial politics and policies? George W.? Nope. It's Big Dick Cheney giving the Russians the middle finger and reigniting the Cold War. And now the polls touted by corporate media tell us that Sarah and her aged co-nominee are neck and neck with Obama and Biden. Let's ignore for the moment the fact that any poll reported by corporate media is highly suspect, and then let's assume that they're accurate. For those not paying attention, John McCain is 72 years old. He's the oldest candidate ever to be nominated by a major party and has survived at least four bouts of cancer. This is a man who, if elected either by fraud or by honest election, stands an excellent chance of not surviving his four-year term. That will leave us with Sarah Palin as leader of the most powerful nation on earth. Sarah Palin has absolutely zero foreign policy experience. In fact, she only got her passport last year. Has she ever traveled outside the United States? Ever met with any world leaders? It's a frightening fact that she has zero experience in Washington, D.C. politics. She has limited experience in Alaskan politics. Do we want such a person with her finger on the nuclear button? George W. is scary enough. John McCain and his legendary quick temper and shoot-from-the-hip style is scarier still. But someone with no experience of the world outside of her remote state? Unbelievable. I realize that most of my listeners are probably going to vote Democratic. But if anyone listening is planning or even considering voting for McCain and Palin, please call in and give me your thinking. I promise to be polite and non-confrontational, but I really do want to know why you're considering voting for McCain and Palin. You can phone in studio at 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. Okay, on with the rest of the show. A listener called in on Paul Emery's show last week and brilliantly summed up the whole racial issue in the upcoming election. He did so with one simple question. Why, he asked, is Obama characterized as black when his mother was a white woman from Kansas? Next item. Speaking of fraudulent versus honest elections, Mike Masnick, writing in TechDirt.com from the Wonder Never Ceases department, Diebold, Premier, actually admits its machines are faulty and that it lied about antivirus software. Consider me to be in a state of shock. For nearly half a decade, Diebold has always responded in the identical way to every single report of a problem or security vulnerability with its e-voting machines, attacking those who pointed out the problem and claiming it really wasn't a problem at all. This has happened time and time again. so many times that I'm not even sure how to react when the company, renamed Premier to get away from the Diebold name stigma, has finally admitted that its machines have a flaw that drops votes. Oops. It's warning 34 states that use of the machines of the problem which was highlighted in the lawsuit Ohio filed against Premier Diebold. Not only that, but it's admitting the flaw in the software has been in the software for the past decade. So why was the company blaming antivirus software just a couple of months ago? It should also make us question Premier Diebold's longstanding claim that independent outsiders should not be allowed to inspect its machines for problems. Of course, Diebold execs are already downplaying all of this, claiming that they were confident that this hadn't actually impacted any elections, though they offer no proof of that. The company's president admits he's distressed that they were wrong in their previous analysis, but he fails to explain why the company is so against letting outsiders inspect the machines to avoid such flaws. In the meantime, the company insists that the problems will be patched in time for the November election, and I'm sure we're all confident that there won't be any other problems with their machines, right? That was Mike Masnick writing in techdirt.com. Next item. For listeners with strong feelings about medical marijuana, this article might interest you. It's an alert from the Marijuana Policy Project. The bill that would ban employment discrimination against medical marijuana patients, AB 2279, is finally on its way to the governor's desk. All that's needed is for Governor Schwarzenegger's signature, and medical marijuana patients will no longer have to risk being fired for using the medicine that their physician recommended. AB 2279 is narrowly crafted legislation, authored by Assemblyman Mark Leno, Democrat of San Francisco, and sponsored by Americans for Safe Access. It's a narrowly crafted legislation that would ensure that medical marijuana patients could not be fired or denied employment based solely on a positive drug test for marijuana. Even though the legislation carves out exceptions for safety-sensitive positions and doesn't lift the prohibition on coming to work impaired, business and law enforcement interests are urging the governor to veto the bill. We have a call. Please be patient. I'll get to you. If this issue interests you one way or the other, you can write Governor Schwarzenegger today and urge him to sign or not sign AB 2279 into law. Taking action is simple. Just visit the Marijuana Policy Project site, which I assume is marijuanapolicyproject.com or .org. I'm not certain. Enter your contact information and send your email to the governor. Once you've sent your email, please follow up with a phone call to the governor's office. You actually can phone the governor without doing the email first. Just call. Here's the number, 916-445-2841, and tell the operator you're calling to urge Governor Schwarzenegger to either sign or not sign AB 2279. My addendum to this. I called into the governor's office, and the voicemail listed several bills I could immediately comment on. This bill was not one of those listed, and I had to wait about 6 minutes to speak to staff and register my wishes. I asked why this bill was not one of those listed for prompt action. I was told it was because the other bills had received a lot of calls and this issue had not. So, if this issue interests you one way or the other, you can call the governor and tell him whether you want to vote yay or nay on AB 2279 on medical marijuana. And the number to call, 916-445-2841. Okay, caller, you're live on the air.
Yes, Mom, if you want to one-up on that Diebold situation, there's a brilliant DVD at the Nevada City Library called Hacking Democracy.
Hacking Democracy,
yes,
a DVD available at the Nevada City Library.
Yes.
Which means it might be available at your local library wherever you're listening.
Yes.
Thank you very much. The name of it again.
Hacking Democracy.
Hacking Democracy.
It's quite stunning.
Okay, thanks for your call.
You too.
Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hi. Thanks for your show. I sure like it.
Thank you.
I just want to make one point about the black or whiteness of an individual. In that this is being used once again, it seems to me that it's not only racism, but it's also reverse racism, because all the U.S. courts, if anyone knows their history about the struggle of black people, would know that the United States of America courts always discerned the black or whiteness of the child in accordance to the black or whiteness of the mother.
Oh, really?
Yes, and that's a part of our history.
Oh, very interesting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for that. Okay. Just as an addendum, I also know that in the Jewish religion, whether you're a Jew or not is determined by your mother, not your father. Okay, on with the show. This next article seems to be from the HuffingtonPost.com, but I'm not certain. This week's mainstream coverage of the presidential horse race has been dominated by a series of polls showing the McCain-Palin ticket with its first stable lead over Obama and Biden. Gallup's tracking poll, USA Today, and CBS News all show the Republicans with some kind of lead over the Democratic ticket. But interestingly, all three polls were also conducted using a higher sampling of Republican voters than in July, raising a question of methodology. In a year in which Democrats have a lead of 11 million registered voters over Republicans, and have been adding to that advantage through a robust field operation, are pollsters oversampling Republicans? Despite a raft of advantages in the electorate for Democrats, in September's first Gallup tracking poll, an equal number of Republican and Democrats were surveyed, including leaners. From September 3rd to 5th, compared to a 10-point Democratic identification advantage 2 weeks ago. That partisan makeup of the polling pool resulted in a 5-point lead for McCain in the tracking poll. Meanwhile, the new CBS poll features a 6-point swing in partisan composition towards Republicans, which plays some role in the poll's 2-point lead for McCain. Finally, the latest USA Today poll, which claims a 4-point edge for McCain, was arrived at after a 10-point swing in partisan makeup towards GOP respondents. Some polling experts say the changing state of party affiliations in the field is slow to be reflected in polls themselves. Democratic pollster Anna Greenberg told the Huffington Post that when it comes to registration and turnout, the polls often do a very bad job of taking those factors into account, because newly registered voters aren't in the voter files used by firms that survey public opinion. You could make the argument they're underrepresenting new registers, she said, which would mean that the Democrats' new edge would not be taken into account. Monday's USA Today poll had a 48-47 split between Democrats and Republicans surveyed. That represents a nearly 10-point shift in party identification towards Republicans since their July polling. When asked for comment, USA Today polling editor Jim Norman wrote that it's possible that their latest sampling includes too many Republicans, though he added, it's also possible that we have too many Democrats, because there's always the chance of an over- or under-representation in polls. Translation, he said nothing. Still, Norman admitted that the GOP identification in the latest survey had spiked. The party ID in our most recent poll does not show any shift away from what Gallup has been getting in earlier polls, going all the way back to 2005. But previous conventions, the Republicans in 88, the Democrats in 92, the Democrats in 2000, have also shown shifts in party ID toward the party that had the convention, and those shifts seem to last to a greater or lesser degree through the election. I have no idea what that means. Further, I've been told by Gallup that their tracking poll has shown a similar shift in party ID since the Republican convention. I guarantee you we'll be watching closely in all of our polls between now and Election Day to see whether there are any further shifts in party ID in either direction. That was the USA Today representative, and like I say, what he said means nothing to me. Okay, some more statistics, which I don't think translate very well. Emory University political scientist Alan Abramowitz is highly skeptical of the new Gallup, USA Today, and CBS polls. About the latter, which showed a statistically insignificant 2-point lead for McCain, Abramowitz said, "One reason for the dramatic difference between the two recent CBS polls is that the two samples differed fairly dramatically in terms of partisan composition. First sample was 35% Democratic, 26% Republican, 38% Independent. Second sample was 34% Democratic, 31% Republican, and 34% Independent. That's a change from a 9-point Democratic advantage to a 3.8-point Democratic advantage. That alone would probably explain about half of the difference in candidate preferences between the two CBS polls. If these polls are improperly reflecting the partisan makeup of the electorate at large, it certainly would go a part of the way toward explaining anything beyond the quick dead cat bounce after the Republican convention. And if the convergence of polls around a small McCain lead has anything to do with sampling error, it would render any claims about a new equilibrium in the race moot. One day before USA Today announced its new poll numbers, it also ran an Associated Press story with a headline, "Democrats Post Big Gains in Voter Registration." In that article, the AP noted that during the primary season, more than 2 million Democrats were added to voter rolls in the 28 states that register voters according to party affiliation. The Republicans have lost nearly 344,000 voters in the same states. The article proceeded to lay out a variety of statistics that favor Democrats. Nationwide, there are about 42 million registered Democrats and about 31 million registered Republicans. And this was stats compiled by the Associated Press. The Democrats have posted big gains in many competitive states, including Nevada, New Hampshire, Iowa, Colorado, and Florida. They have also been targeting historically Republican southern states. Since 2006, the Democrats have added 167,000 voters in North Carolina, while the Republicans have added 36,000. Still, that doesn't discount the fact that Republicans have definitely made some gains. As Greenberg notes, Sarah Palin came out and gave a really good speech. She certainly exceeded the low expectations. And then more people watched McCain's speech than Obama. And now it appears that there was a bigger bump for McCain than there was for Obama. But there's always been more room to grow his vote. Greenberg says the prior lack of enthusiasm amongst Republicans could have resulted in an inflated rate of survey respondents identifying as independents. The CBS panel show most of the movement came to McCain from undecided voters, people who were probably holding back from McCain, Greenberg said. Despite the Abramowitz simply doesn't think the overall spike in Republican sampling amongst all three polling firms is an accurate reflection of the electorate. It's just not likely, he says. Given how important polls can be in the coverage of the race, even a slight assist to McCain during a period in which he's exciting the Republican base could help him solidify a new narrative in the race, regardless of the partisan facts on the ground. Well, there you have it, folks. Polls by way of corporate media. Do you know any more now than before I read you this article? We had a caller. Caller's gone, so call again if you want to be on the air. Meanwhile, I'm going to read you an article by Paul Roget Loeb from the Online Journal. It's called "The Rovian Politics of Choosing Sarah Palin." What does it say about John McCain that he not only picked the least experienced vice presidential nominee in America's history, but picked someone he really didn't even know? Departing so far from any normal concept of appropriate background, he should at least have had a sense of why this individual is so special. Meeting Palin once at a Republican governor's conference and having a single phone conversation on the eve of her selection just doesn't pass muster, particularly for the oldest presidential candidate ever, who's had four malignant melanomas. What makes Palin such a cynical choice is that McCain doesn't know her and doesn't know what drives her. Until she was selected by the Karl Rove type running his campaign, like campaign manager and Rove protege Steve Schmidt, McCain might not have even have recognized her on the street. Instead, she's a category selection made for the crassest reasons by the same kinds of political operative who brought us George W. Bush. Their motives are obvious. Palin is an energetic and attractive woman who just might pick up some disgruntled Hillary supporters. She's a Westerner and a hunter who might appeal to rural voters. She might energize a previously tepid base of hard-shell religious conservatives through her opposition to abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. These attributes may indeed prove her worthy as a vote-getter, but they have no relation to Palin's fitness for the job. McCain can't have any sense of what ties beneath the marketing categories, who Palin actually is, what she could contribute to the vice presidential office, and what it would be like to work together, because he doesn't know her and has had no chance to. It's like so much that the Republicans have done for 8 years and longer, making choices with the gravest possible consequences based largely on political expediency. Leave aside all the other troubling questions about Palin, her extreme abortion position, her backing the infamous Bridge to Nowhere, while campaigning for governor, then later claiming to disavow it. Her denial of global warming and embrace of creationism. Her Cheney-style vendetta of firing the Alaskan public safety director who refused to fire her former brother-in-law from his job as a state trooper. Leave aside Palin's actual record, because John McCain barely knows it, and his vetters didn't even bother to go through the archives of her local newspaper or talk with a former public safety director she fired. What choosing her shows instead is a politics that once again subordinates any greater common good to a raw pursuit of power. It echoes McCain praising Jerry Falwell after once calling him an agent of intolerance, or embracing Bush's campaign and administration after Bush's political hitmen defeated him in South Carolina with swift boat type lies, or when instead of challenging Obama's ideals, the McCain campaign tried to caricature him as a one step up from Britney Spears and Paris Hilton. Karl Rove's minions may be smiling at the brazen gamesmanship of this pick, but if Americans fall for it, they should know all too well what to expect. That was Paul Rogay Loeb writing an online journal. The time is 12:34 in the p.m. The station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is John Belain. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. We're going to go on for another 25 minutes. And after that, we're going to be followed by Second Wind with Mel Walsh. This next article was sent to me. It's called Different Outlooks. If you're a minority and you're selected for a job over more qualified candidates, you're a token hire. If you're a conservative and you're selected for a job over more qualified candidates, you're a game changer. Black teenage pregnancies, a crisis in Black America. White teenage pregnancies, a blessed event. If you grow up in Hawaii, you're exotic. If you grow up in Alaska eating moose burgers, you're the quintessential American story. Similarly, if you name your kid Barack, you're unpatriotic. Name your kid Track, you're colorful. If you're a Democrat and you made a vice presidential pick without fully vetting the individual, you're reckless. A Republican who doesn't fully vet is a maverick. If you spend 3 years as a community organizer, growing your organization from a staff of 1 to 13, and your budget from $70,000 to $400,000, and then become the first Black president of the Harvard Law Review, create a voter registration drive that registers 150,000 new African-American voters, spend 12 years as a constitutional law professor, then spend nearly 8 more years as a state senator representing a district with over 750,000 people, becoming chairman of the state Senate Health and Human Services Committee, then spend nearly 4 years in the United States Senate representing a state of nearly 13 million people, sponsoring 131 bills and serving on the Foreign Affairs, Environment and Public Works and Veterans Affairs Committee, you're woefully inexperienced. If you spend 4 years on the city council and 6 years as the mayor of a town with less than 7,000 people, then spend 20 months as the governor of a state with 650,000 people, then you've got the most executive experience of anyone on either ticket. Are the commander-in-chief of the Alaskan military and are well qualified to leave the nation should you be called upon to do so because your state is the closest state to Russia. If you're a Democratic male candidate who's popular with millions of people, you're an arrogant celebrity. If you're a popular Republican female candidate, you're energizing the base. If you are a younger male candidate who thinks of himself and thinks for himself and makes his own decisions, you're presumptuous. If you're an older male candidate who makes last-minute decisions you refuse to explain, you're a shoot-from-the-hip maverick. If you're a candidate with a Harvard Law degree, you're an elitist, out of touch with a real America. If you're a legacy, dad and granddad were admirals, graduate of Annapolis. If you're a legacy graduate of Annapolis, because your dad and granddad were admirals, with multiple disciplinary infractions, you're a hero. If you manage a multi-million dollar nationwide campaign, you're an empty suit. If you're a part-time mayor of a town of 7,000 people, you're an experienced executive. If you go to a south side of Chicago church, your beliefs are extremist. If you believe in creationism and don't believe global warming is man-made, you're strongly principled. If you cheated on your first wife with a rich heiress and left your disfigured wife and married the heiress the next month, you're a Christian. If you've been married to the same woman with whom you've been wed to for 19 years and raised two beautiful daughters with, you're risky. If you're a black single mother of four who waits 22 hours after her water breaks to seek medical attention, you're an irresponsible parent endangering the life of your unborn child. But if you're a white married mother who waits 22 hours, you're spunky. If you're a 13-year-old Chelsea New Clinton, the right-wing press calls you first dog. If you're a 17-year-old pregnant, unwed daughter of a Republican, the right-wing press calls you beautiful and courageous. If you kill an endangered species, you're an excellent hunter. If you have an abortion, you're not a Christian. If you're a murderer, and forget about it, that it happened while being raped. If you teach abstinence only in sex education, you get teen parents. If you teach responsible, age-appropriate sex education, including the proper use of birth control, you're eroding the fiber of society. If you're a Republican senator who solicits gay sex in an airport bathroom, you get to return to your job in the Senate and are encouraged to run for re-election. If you're a Democratic senator who's out of public office and have an affair, your political career is over and your wife, who has terminal cancer, is to blame. Not sure of the source of that. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, this is Bob Warren. And what I'm really disturbed about is the polarization of everyone that listens to any kind of talk radio. We don't even have any choice. You know, it's either Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Glenn Beck, and we don't have anybody else.
Yeah, that's a very serious problem with communications in America and the takeover of the broadcast airwaves by the right wing.
The thing is that we have really no way, nowhere to go, because we don't have the ability to start up. Look what happened to Air America Radio.
What did happen? For those that are unfamiliar, what did happen to Air America Radio?
Well, I mean, they were underfunded advertising-wise because other corporate media said that if there was advertising done on Air America, then they pulled the plug on their advertising on the other station.
Right. Money talks.
Yes, and unfortunately, they have more of it than we do.
Well, they have more of it than anybody does. I don't know who we is. They've got more of it than anybody. Yes.
But I mean, you know, you're pretty much preaching to the choir in our sphere of audience that you have. That you know, and I just try to stay as much in touch as I can, and whenever I have the opportunity to speak with somebody about the rationale of just where we are in the our economy,
yeah,
I get some kind of an open ear from from right wing people.
Good.
But the problem is that there's a lot of people that don't even want to engage.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're so afraid to hear something that might be a different point of view that they just kind of turn off.
My take on people who vote Republican, and this is only my opinion, is that they would vote Republican if the candidate was Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler. They're just going to vote Republican, and there's no thought at all involved. That's my personal opinion, and that's based on talking with people.
And your opinion is not unfounded.
Yep.
And right on.
Okay.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you for your call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hey there.
You're live on KVMR.
Yes. My, you know, my hitch on the whole shenanigans going on with the polls is that, you know, they almost got caught with the nefarious vote stealing and shenanigans going on with the last election,
right,
behind those polls. So all this is just they're going to manicure them pretty good this time. So it looks closer than it is. So.
Ah, very good point.
You know, they're just going to thicken the pot about tracking them down.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on.
Okay. Yep. Very good point.
Thanks for the show, bro.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Okay, speaking of election shenanigans, there's an election observer arrested in Arizona. This is a post from Steven Rosenfeld in Alternet. Will cops crack down on election observers in November? According to the Election Defense Alliance, heretofore referred to as EDA, according to their blog, John Blakely, one of the country's leading election activists, known for being secretive, known to bring secretive electronic voting into public view, was arrested while observing problems in local elections this week in Pima County, Arizona. The arrest begs the question of whether the same response will be forthcoming against election observers this November. The scenario is hardly moot after the police used excessive force in St. Paul in response to protests and other First Amendment activities at the Republican National Convention. The EDA blog reports that Blakely was arrested while officially observing the vote count. This is from the EDA blog, the Election Defense Alliance blog. While monitoring a hand count of ballots from the September 3rd Arizona primary, in his capacity as an official election observer for the Democratic and Libertarian parties, EDA Investigations co-coordinator John Blakely was arrested and ejected from the Pima County Election Headquarters on orders of Pima County Election Director Brad Nelson. Blakely had noticed that several of the incoming bags containing ballots from the precincts had unsecured or missing seals. The seal failures appeared to be the result of poll workers not knowing how to properly lock them. Blakely then wondered whether the serial numbers on the bag seals matched the serial numbers recorded by the precinct poll workers when they sealed the ballots. One question led to another, and Blakely ended up in handcuffs. Seal serial numbers are supposed to be recorded on yellow report sheets, called end-of-day certification reports. The certification sheets are supposed to be signed by all the precinct poll workers and included with the ballots inside the delivery bags. The bags are supposed to remain sealed until open for counting at county election headquarters. In one bag, instead of the signed official certification sheets, there was instead a slip of white paper with what Blakely said were two illegible scrawled signatures. Blakely watched election manager Brad Nelson read the slip, say he recognized who the two poll workers were, and approve acceptance of that bag of ballots for counting. Remember, that bag was not sealed. Blakely found it rather remarkable that Nelson would be so familiar with the county's 3,000 poll workers that he could identify two of them by illegible scrawls on a slip of paper. Blakely then began checking other incoming ballot bags. In the first seven successive ballot bags he checked, the required yellow certification reports were missing. This included bags with open seals, as well as bags with seals intact. As Blakely was speaking to members of the counting panels, alerting them to his discoveries, Election Director Nelson came up to him and told him to leave. Blakely replied that he was appointed to be an election observer, and he intended to stay on the job until closing time at 1 a.m. Nelson told him to leave immediately or he'd be arrested. Blakely refused. At that point, a deputy sheriff present placed Blakely under arrest for trespassing, handcuffed him, and removed him from the building. Once outside, Blakely requested his legally allowed phone call and placed it to his attorney. Word of Blakely's arrest immediately went out to the network of election integrity activists Blakely had built with a grassroots group, audit.az. Shortly thereafter, the county elections building was swarming with television news crews. So, there you have elections in the state of Arizona, which, of course, is the state John McCain comes from. Okay, I think we've belabored the election enough. We're going to switch topics. This one is Osentia. Is an independent Osentia inevitable after Kosovo, or a U.S. election ruse gone wrong? And do we have a call? No. This is by Eric Wahlberg, writing an online journal, and he writes for Al-Ahram Weekly. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave a gritty, straight-talking 30-minute interview with CNN this week in Russian. It was not translated or reported reported on widely in the U.S. media, which is a shame. Okay, we now have a call. You're going to have to wait until the end of this article. He charged that U.S. The call may relate to what we talked about before, so if you're still there... Nope, they hung up. Putin charged that U.S. military personnel were in South Ossetia during the attack and lectured about such topics as Ossetia's long membership in the Russian Empire, which is since 1801, and Osenshin's age-old resentment of Georgian chauvinism, especially following the 1917 Russian Revolution and the 1990 Declaration of Georgian Independence. A South Ossetian legislator has already raised the possibility that it will eventually become part of the Russian Federation. When asked by CNN if he would stop threatening neighbors now that the Ossetian crisis was over, he angrily dismissed the question as preposterous, saying it was up to the U.S. and its new Eastern European clients to stop threatening Russia. It is the Polish and Czech missile bases and Ukrainian and Georgian desire to join in the nuclear-tipped encirclement of Russia that are the destabilizing developments forcing Russia to batten the hatches. The Russians see the bases as a precursor to a much larger system that would undermine the already seriously eroded Russian nuclear deterrent. For the first time in history, and I want to emphasize this, there will be elements of the U.S. nuclear capability on the European continent. It simply changes the whole configuration of international security. Of course we have to respond to that. This said by Putin in a press conference last year, which was also not reported in the corporate U.S. media. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov underlined Putin's words on Monday, referring to the reality of the post-American world and warning that in the absence of a reasonable multilateral dialogue, we will be forced to react unilaterally. Europe's inability to produce new collective security system, open for everyone, and taking into account everyone's interests, was to blame for the Georgian crisis. He added, there's a feeling that the NATO again needs frontline states to justify its existence. As if to make his point, the Russian military carried out a successful test of a Topol RS-12M nuclear-capable stealth rocket from the Plesetsk Space Center. Analysts are already speculating that Putin may well take out the Polish nuclear site. I'm sorry, the Polish missile site. Mike Whitney at Online Journal writes that he has no other option. The proposed system integrates the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal into one operational unit a mere 115 miles from the Russian border. It's no different than Khrushchev's plan to deploy nuclear missiles in Cuba in the 60s. At the very least, Putin will be forced to raise the stakes and send warplanes over the construction site. That's the logical first step that any responsible leader would take before removing the site altogether. So if Cold War II keeps accelerating and something like this happens later this year, what should we make of it? Is this Russia threatening and even invading its neighbor? Or is it a justifiable warning to the U.S. to back down from its attempts to instigate World War III? Is it possible that all this for-all is really just an early October surprise in the U.S. electoral tradition that both Reagan and Bush II made such masterful use of? Recall that Ronald Reagan's advisors orchestrated a delay in returning U.S. hostages from Iran in 1980, tipping the balance in his favor in the elections that year. Then President George W. Bush got a letter purportedly from Osama bin Laden weeks before the election in 2004, conveniently reminding Americans that he is their defender against terrorists. This possibly was the inspiration for the 1998 movie Wag the Dog, where a few weeks before the elections, a presidential advisor hires a Hollywood producer to fabricate and market a war in an ex-socialist bloc country to ensure the incumbent's re-election. In the current reality show version, discretion is thrown completely to the wind, with a certain Randy Schuneman playing both doctor and advisor to Republican incumbent Senator John McCain. Schuneman's two-man Orion Strategies lobby firm has been advising Latvia since 2001 and more recently, Georgia. Georgia hopes to follow Latvia's success in joining NATO and, why not, the European Union. It's already paid Orion Strategies $300,000 to this end. Putin firmly declared in his CNN interview that the attack on Russian peacekeepers by Georgia was given the green light by U.S. officials as part of a U.S. election campaign ploy. But Putin is caught between a rock and a hard place in this U.S. election year. Even if he's right about Schuneman, McCain's advisor has his counterpart in Senator Barack Obama's chief foreign policy advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, while being no fan of Bush, is rubbing his hands in glee over the Russian move to protect Ossetia. So whoever wins in November will undoubtedly push CW2 into higher gear, Cold War II into high gear, come what may. Will this Wag the Dog sequel bring in the votes for McCain? That is far from certain, considering his admiration for the now despised Bush, his endless gaffes, and his patent lack of intelligence. However, the key to U.S. elections, the Israel lobby, is not happy with Brzezinski and could scuttle Obama's candidacy, despite Obama's choice of self-proclaimed Zionist Senator Joe Biden as his running mate. Recall that Brzezinski was foreign policy advisor to ex-President Jimmy Carter, whose Camp David Accords forced Israel to give the Sinai back to Egypt. Enter Schunemann. He has no such skeletons in his closet, and he's a big fan of the current Middle East makeover designed to ensure Israel's supremacy. As director of Ahmad Shalabi's Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, he pushed for the invasion in 2003. Mission accomplished, he found his new warrior prince in Tbilisi. Schunemann is just one of dozens of U.S. and Israeli advisors to the trigger-happy Georgian president. Israel has been actively supporting Saakashvili, eager to see the Georgian pipeline project bypassing Russia completed. Georgian Defense Minister David Kazarashvili and Minister of Reintegration Timur Yabobashvili are both Israeli citizens who returned to Georgia to enter politics. That's an interesting fact that's never mentioned. Back to the article. If, in fact, the U.S.-Israeli lobby has decided on McCain for president and passed the word on to Schunemann, this could well account for the green light that Saakashvili clearly thought he had to attack Russian peacekeeping troops and Osetia civilians, killing hundreds, if not the 1,500 claimed by Russia. And what better way to force both candidates to shore up Bush's policy of war and death, just in case by some fluke the suspicious Obama overcomes the many hurdles to a candidate not enjoying the full confidence and control of the lobby. You can't fault Obama for trying to please them, short of firing his patron Brzezinski. Already he's dropped his willingness to talk to the enemy, which clearly means Russia these days, every bit as much as Iran. Under him, Iraq will keep its U.S. bases, and Afghanistan will absorb any troops who leave Iraq. Whether or not Washington succeeds in bringing Georgia and Ukraine into NATO is the only moot point in all of this, and this really depends more on Russia than on who inhabits the White House for the next 4 years. This is all very much like Brzezinski's scheming as advisor to President Carter. He now boasts that by orchestrating U.S. funding of an Islamic extremist like bin Laden from 79 on, he was responsible for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union. This did nothing to wag Carter's dog back into power in 1980, but that is of little consequence to these shadowy advisors, who are never without work in the higher echelons of U.S. politics, such as Schumann, will not suffer in the least if his candidate is found to have Alzheimer's and forgets to show for his inauguration next January. And if Obama wins, he'll merely cede his White House pass to Brzezinski and continue advising world's leaders such as the hapless Georgian president. It's quite possible that this ratcheting up of tensions in the Caucasus is intentional. It clinched the Polish missile deal in a hurry and put Russia in a bad light, giving succor to those planning to make the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline the key link in a network bypassing Russia. But the Georgian pipeline was shut down by BP during the recent conflict, and it is far from clear that spin doctors and tweaking the Russian bear's nose will bring the U.S. any closer to cutting Russia down to size. What this episode and Putin's steely evaluation did was to further expose the poison at the heart of American politics and confirm the world's suspicions that Russia is not afraid to stand up for itself. Let's go out with this. The next time someone asks you a dumb question, would you like to respond like, oh, we got a call. Caller, we're almost out of time. Please be brief.
Okay, this is brief. If people are vacillating on the Sarah Palin issue,
right,
there is a second fact-checking organization composed of some 500 women that a friend of mine in Alaska referred me to,
right,
who is a political science teacher.
Right.
And it's located at http://politicsanew, P-O-L-I-T-I-C-S, ANEW.com, and if you then enter /2008/9/04/.
But you know, people aren't going to be able to remember that.
Okay, well, just Politics Anew. There's
Politics Anew.
Yeah, there's a article there on fact-checking the
Fine.
Sarah Palin acceptance speech that they ought to read, that documents Sarah Palin's actual performance and voting record, both as mayor and as governor.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we've got three calls and no time, so I'm sorry about that, but in the future, try and phone in earlier, because I don't have time to take your call.